Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Today our guest is Stephen R. Blank. Stephen is the Senior Resident Fellow of Finance for the Urban Land Institute. One of his many tasks is a principal researcher for the Emerging Trends in Real Estate Annual Report. In the past, Stephen has also been involved in investment banking, financing public offerings, and property acquisition. Stephen, welcome to our show.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
The 2009 Emerging Trends Report is the 30th edition. So has this always been an annual report then going back 30 years?
Yes.
Okay. So this goes back to the late 70s. So this really does show a history of what's gone on in the country. Has it always been national, or was it ever just did it start smaller?
No, it started as a national publication. It was originally the work product of the Equitable Real Estate Company, which was the insurance investing and lending arm of Equitable Life Assurance of America. And it really stayed in that format for a number of years. Then it was joint ventured with another company and eventually ended up as a joint venture between the Urban Land Institute and PricewaterhouseCoopers.
The current format is to interview hundreds of people involved in the real estate business and compile their collective opinions as to what the next year is going to look like. What was the mood of those questioned last year as we headed into 2008?
Well, it's interesting. The market, the people we interviewed, which is just a wide array of industry participants, and it's institutional investors and public and private owners and developers and advisors and service providers and conventional and securitized lenders. So it's a broad picture of the landscape of the real estate industry. Clearly, had you followed their advice, clearly told you what 2007 and 2008 and 2009 were going to be like, that we were going to be going into a very difficult period, that markets had gotten ahead of themselves, that financing was too readily available, that there was too much global liquidity, that loans were being made, without the same thought to underwriting that we'd seen, in past years, and that, if real estate had morals, the morals had gotten to be, loose and not applied with any, on a stringent basis. So the survey clearly predicted what was going to happen.
I think that makes it a very unusual survey, because most surveys take the temperature of where you are, not where you're going.
Well, what makes Emerging Trends so unique is the one-on-one interview process, which we combine with online and in-print surveys. We talk to this wide array of people. For the U.S. edition, it's in the 500-700 people, per year are involved. And if you look in the back of the book, if someone has a copy of the book, you can see a list of the people we survey. So it's sort of the who's who. And people are very frank in these one-on-one interviews because they know nothing is for attribution. Everything, is used to try to, find the industry trends and what the year is going to look like. So it's almost written from the perspective of, it's the end of 2009. If I look back and say, what happened, what are people telling me they expect to happen during that period?
I just think it's unusual that they are so forthright, because a lot of times the agendas get in the way and maybe even wishful thinking. And it doesn't sound like that typically happens in this report, so that's fantastic.
Well, look, there's certainly some blue sky, but there is no editorial bias. One person is the actual writer of the book. Three of us are principal researchers with him, and, de facto, we're the editors just reading for content to make sure that, we don't... We don't miss something, or we don't interpret something incorrectly. We're just fortunate. The industry supports this publication with a tremendous amount of resolve, and people, have been interviewed, for literally the entire 30 years. I was interviewed for over 20 years before I went to when I was an investment banker. So I think people are very loyal to the publication, and it, what I liked is it always provided me a chance to sort of do my own internal survey of what I thought the next year was going to look like and how I should be allocating my resources. So it forced me to plan, and I think a lot of people use the interview process as a planning device for their own companies.
When things are going well and the mood toward real estate is positive, people tend to overpay, builders tend to overbuild, over-leverage, and lenders assist in making that all possible. Did lenders go a little too far this time?
Well, I think you know, there's enough blame to go around,
okay.
In all fairness. I think we certainly went through a period of unparalleled liquidity in the global capital markets. And I think that period of liquidity began, you know, in the early part of this decade and just kept accelerating. With that liquidity, you know, came a increasing demand for income-producing assets, and real estate is historically one of the, you know, strongest candidates in people's minds as an income-producing asset. With that liquidity came increased competition, both to lend money, and so interest rates were forced to their lowest levels in certainly the past 40 years in anybody's, you know, remembrance of interest rates. And that increased liquidity and increased availability of leverage allowed for greater competition for income-producing real estate, therefore pushing down the rates of return. So, you know, I don't cast the lenders as the, you know, as the people with the that we should be the most, you know, concerned about their behavior. I mean, there was, you know, there's enough blame to pass around. I mean, if we look at the subprime market, you know, it's hard to argue the fact that it's an unregulated industry, that the mortgage brokers who, you know, initiated the transactions aren't regulated. There are no rules like you have on the stock exchanges where you have to know your customer, and the investment has to be suitable, the mortgage has to be suitable. The mortgage bankers who accumulate the loans are really in the business of accumulation, not in doing due diligence. And it goes on from step to step until they get to Wall Street that packages the loans and takes them to the rating agencies. The rating agencies apply models. Now, some might argue these models are historically too old or they're flawed, but they're models that have worked in the past. And the institutional investors are willing to buy the securities just using, you know, the ratings from the rating agencies, not doing any due diligence. So there's sort of a failure in due diligence throughout the process, leading to this massive, you know, overleveraging of the individual investor. We made it too easy. Yeah. People were, you know, in the year 2000, people were day trading stocks, and, you know, then they were day trading the internet. Now they went to day trading condos.
That's right.
So you know,
if it's working, people throw money at it. That's how it works.
Well, you know, and look, I'm not going to point fingers at any one bank or another, but I remember receiving a letter from one of the that was sent to me by someone that he had received from one of the financial institutions, major financial institution, saying they were going to scale back their business, that individual investors could not have 12 individual mortgages on property. They were going to scale it back to 4.
Mm-hmm.
One might argue, what does an individual investor have? Where is his business having 12 houses? Doesn't that argue, you know, a little bit of an excess in some way?
You know, if the word is investor, I would argue no. If it was speculator, I would argue, of course.
Right. You're right. I mean, I think you're right. And I mean, clearly, look, there was a lot of speculation. People using houses like ATM machines.
Yes. And they confuse themselves with investors. So it's interesting you brought that up. I wasn't going to. But right now, we've assured ourselves that to continue this housing downturn because we have now limited the investor to 4 loans. Including his residence. Here's what that does. We can't 1031 exchange into residential real estate selling a commercial building because we have too much debt, so we can't do that. We can't hold more than 3 rentals and finance them, even if we can buy them for nothing. So these things are either being bought by investors like myself for cash, and because there's not that many takers, Our average purchase this year has been 28 cents on the dollar for what the lenders were owed.
Sure.
If they had financing, they probably could have a buyer that would pay more.
No, you're right. I mean, it's clearly a problem that the government has not addressed, you know, which is stabilizing the single-family housing market. I mean, I'm not an expert in that. I'm an expert in commercial properties and commercial property finance. But it does not take, you know, a rocket scientist to see that, you know, this has not been stabilized. And we've been talking about the subprime and related problems, the Alt-A's, the options arms, and all these resets, and the prime loans for the past 18 months. So it's certainly a disappointment to me that we have not made more progress on this, because we need to if we're going to jumpstart the economy.
When the residential sector does what it has done, basically take an all-time downturn, does it cascade into the commercial sector, and do you view it probably being as severe?
Well, I don't think they're really related.
Okay.
You know, the commercial real estate is much more of a lagging indicator. You need the economy to turn down to start to have an impact on commercial real estate.
Does residential real estate cause that downturn? Or?
Sure.
Okay.
Certainly, residential could cause a downturn in the economy. But the commercial is more the buy player. You know, it's affected by that downturn. You know, companies, start to lay off some employees. They have more space than they need. They either put that space in the market, so there's sublease space, they increase the quantity of space, or they might move to a smaller facility, so that adds to the vacancy. In a declining economy, you know, rents either stagnate or start to, you know, decline as landlords realize they have to become more competitive to get tenants. If people, you know, if the industrial companies need less space, that sort of argues they have less sales, therefore they need less distribution capacity for their product. You know, that argues that sales in retail go down because individuals have less money to spend. Hotel occupancies and rates decline because businesses reduce travel and individuals reduce, you know, their vacation. So that's the vicious cycle, but real estate doesn't lead the problem, it sort of, you know, follows along.
Okay.
And the same thing when there's a recovery. You know, real estate will be a lagging indicator. First, the economy recovers, then corporations start to fill vacancies, then all of a sudden their space is full, then they need larger space, and that, you know, that ripples through the economy. What's a saving grace for real estate, for commercial real estate this time, is that development has been very restrained.
I was just going to ask that. So we didn't overbuild as much as usual.
Right. So what we're not going to have is oversupply meeting under demand. Clearly, we're going to have under demand based upon this recession, but we're not going to have that historical large oversupply like we had in the early part of the 90s.
Now, why didn't that happen? Because it was profitable to do. I wonder why it didn't go crazy like residential did.
Well, I think because the commercial, banks who are the primary lenders for construction lending, you know, kept a much greater control.
Really? Okay.
You know? Now, clearly, we have a lot of condominiums. I mean, there's no argument that parts of Southern California have issues, that Las Vegas has issues, that, you know, Miami, the southern part of Miami has issues and oversupplies they're going to have to work through. They're going to take some time.
Now, you're talking about residential, or are you talking about commercial condo?
Residential.
Residential, okay. Okay.
You know, so, I mean, you know, there are some overbuilding, and clearly, you know, housing is that primary, you know, example in this cycle, but it's commercial is just not overbuilt.
Do you see the commercial lender taking back a record number of properties in 2009 and 2010?
Well, you've really hit on the serious question that concerns the industry, which is obviously we're going to see a sharp increase in delinquencies and foreclosures because properties that were originally financed during the early part of this decade, you know, with 5-year and 7-year loans are going to start to mature sometime between 2009 and 2012. I mean, one estimate is there's $160 billion of securitized mortgages that are going to need to be refinanced. And so those properties that were financed during much more lenient times with maybe loan-to-value ratios of 80 or 85%, debt coverage ratios of maybe 1.05 to 1 or 1.1 to 1 are going to come into the market when debt coverage ratios are 1.25 to 1, when loan-to-value ratios are only 65%. And so unless their income has grown substantially, there may be a gap between their income available for debt service and what they need to finance in the new, more stringent environment. I think your perception that there can be issues in terms of delinquencies and foreclosures is exactly on target.
Does the commercial lender have the ability to just sit down with the owner and say, you know what, let's just let it ride the way it is because I'm a whole lot better off you having this payment structure than me owning your building?
Well, to a point, a lender certainly has the ability to have what we would call performing, non-performing loans, meaning a loan that may be out of balance financially, may be out of balance in terms of metrics like loan-to-value, but is still paying debt service on a current basis. And certainly the lenders, if they can, would like to nurse those properties along until the market strengthens and they're able to effectively grow their income to meet, more stringent underwriting requirements. Not every lender can do that, and lenders can't do that, ad infinitum. So there's going to be some transactions that are going to require financial restructuring.
There's a lot of buildings in where I am, Riverside, California, that are just vacant. And I'm assuming that some of those people have debt service that is getting tough to make. I was wondering, did the residential world had the stated income and subprime. Did commercial financing have anything that really stretch what they normally would have done? Did they take a stated income of the asset to a level that was unsafe, or did they just, did they allow the person to qualify with less stringent requirements?
Well, I think what happens in the commercial business is, the market became increasingly competitive, so that some lenders, rather than lending only on income in place, might look at income from space that's currently vacant and assume it's rented up at the following year's, increased rent per square foot.
Correct. And
so sort of giving credit for vacant space at a higher rate than is currently being achieved in the portfolio. People would start to require lower amounts of reserves. Maybe covenants would be softened. Maybe money that would be required for capital expenditures and escrow would be removed. So all of those things, if the market continues to go up, your property sort of grows into and can afford. But if you go into a period where either the income stagnates or declines, then you don't have excess income for things that are required to keep the property in Class A shape so that it could be rented. So, your perception is correct. You get, the vicious cycle occurs.
Cap rate, I'm just curious about the market's feeling risky. So are the cap rates starting to go up?
Yeah, I think they definitely are. The survey sort of looks to cap rates going up 150 to 200 basis points off the high water mark, which would be the middle of between 2006 and 2007.
How does that depreciate the asset? What percentage would a 2% cap rate, let's say it was 6?
Well, without trying to work the numbers out.
Okay,
exactly. I mean, you could be looking at certainly 15 to 20% declines in values off the mid 2007 peaks. Now, obviously, a trophy property in a gateway location suffers less. A property in a weaker market suffers more.
Are a lot of personal guarantees behind commercial financing?
Not as many as you'd think. We as an industry, people really learned their lessons in the 90s. Financing remained very constrained for a number of years. And so the personal guarantees really have sort of been taken out of the business. Going forward now, to get a loan, it is certainly not unheard of to have a lender ask for a personal guarantee of some portion of the loan.
Is commercial financing usually amortized, or does it usually have a call date?
Well, you keep isolating all the problems, so you've obviously done your homework. historically, loans, had an amortization period. It would be very typical for a loan to be written with a 10-year term, assuming a 25-year amortization period. So at the end of 10 years, you might have amortized somewhere around 12 or 13% of the loan, and that's obviously an added protection to the lender because the property's value could decline by 12 to 13%, and it'd still be enough money to pay the lender off. As the markets became more and more competitive, the amortization periods eventually were eliminated and loans became interest only. So a substantial amount of the loans written in the 86-87 period were interest only. And so the difficulty is when these are refinanced, the lender has had, you know, none of the benefit of even a moderate payoff when they hit the refinancing wall.
Do we expect a pretty healthy rise in unemployment for the next 2 years? And if so, how does that affect commercial real estate?
Well, you know, I think that all, you know, gets baked into the economy. Clearly that, I'm not an economist, so I can't predict what portion of that, you know, is white collar and affects office space and what portion of that is manufacturing and affects the industrial space. But clearly, it's a body blow to both sides. We're going to see increased vacancy rates. We're starting to see them now. We're going to start to see declining lease rates, and expenses and taxes are obviously not going down. So that's going to have a tough impact on building owners.
Who typically finances, let's say, a commercial, say a hotel or either that or maybe a mall? Do REITs and insurance companies get involved in?
Well, real estate investment trusts are not really originators of debt.
Okay.
They are more likely buyers of existing mortgage product. There's one group that only invests in home mortgages, so they're usually only buying paper that's originated by the government agencies, the Fannies and the Freddies and people like that.
Okay.
There are some mortgage REITs, but they're not traditionally originators of loans. They're more likely buyers of existing loans, or they might originate mezzanine, the loans that fit between the equity and a first mortgage. So they're not directly what you and I would call a conventional lender.
I just want to make sure I understand. Do REITs usually own the properties? Do they do that?
Yeah, REITs are primarily owners.
Okay.
Of income-producing properties.
Okay.
The primary lenders historically have been commercial banks at probably about 40% of the market. Insurance companies for about 20% of the market. And commercial mortgage-backed securities for about 40% of the market.
Okay. Now, has commercial mortgage-backed securities pretty much dried up and gone away?
One might argue it's on life support.
Okay.
You know, the number, these are not private numbers. These are, known, all over the place. There's been somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 billion of CMBS issued in 2008 versus about $225 billion in 2007. So
5%.
Market's down clearly 90%.
Yeah. Now, do the insurance companies feel the same way, but they still have an interest?
Look, the insurance companies are very interested in real estate, but, they have a finite amount of money that's already allocated to the real estate space. And, it's difficult for them to change allocations quickly. They have a number of business models, including life, health, accident, disability, property, casualty. So they have all these other lines of insurance, all of which need to be reserved for with regulatory agencies. So even for them to move capital from one line of business to another takes time. It's a little bit like turning an aircraft carrier.
Yes.
You can have everyone lean to the left, but it takes a couple miles before you get traction. It's the same thing here.
Okay.
So they're a source. They're a major source. They're an important source, but they're being very selective because they sort of have their pick of the litter.
All right. Stephen, that's the end of our time. Stephen Blank from the Urban Land Institute, we thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.